Our guest today is the UK's leading media medic and star of Channel 4's Embarrassing Bodies, Dr. Pixie McKenna. Known for her empathic and straightforward advice, she's going to be sharing her take as a doctor on the fascinating links between our physical health and mental well-being, talking all about the challenges and blessings of motherhood and the power of finding your tribe. Okay, Dr. Pixie, you're welcome.
Thank you. Really pleased to be here. Good to meet you.
Oh, it's great to have you here. We like to start off these conversations by asking our guests to tell us one thing that they're grateful for today. So I'd love to hear what that thing is for you.
I am absolutely hugely grateful for my friends and family, really. They are my lifeline. They pick me up when I'm down. They bring me down when I'm too up. Mm. And yeah, being the front and center of all the good things I've done and any of the bad things I've done, they've been there as well. So I am hugely grateful for that, really.
Amazing. Were you able to stay connected with your family during, you know, lockdown?
It was very hard because I was stuck for, I think, about 14 months where I couldn't travel to Ireland.
Yeah.
And my father's on his own. So I, you know, he's 87, quite good with the tech. So I just FaceTime him every day and have a chat. And actually, that was brilliant. But not being able to go, normally I would go every 6 weeks and I would sort of check out the family, see that everyone's all right, reconnect. And I've done that for the last 25 years while I've lived in the UK. So it's the longest time I've ever, ever, ever not seen any of my family physically.
Yeah.
But if we were in pandemic, you know, many years ago, 100 years ago, I wouldn't have been able to do that. I would have had to write letters. So hey, I'm grateful for that too. Grateful for being able to do it.
So it seems like you have a positive mindset, you know, the way you reframe that. And I guess I've just asked you what you're grateful for. How important is gratitude in your life?
Hugely important. Mm. I mean, from a really, really young age, my mum used to go, come into the room, open all the windows and doors in the morning and say, get up, be glad you have your two arms and your two legs and you can stand up and breathe the air. Come on, you all need to be doing something. And I, you know, used to drive us mad. We used to throw things at her and everything. But the point being that actually, unless you look around you and take some gratitude from where you are, there's always something good in every day. And there's always, I know life throws you some terrible curveballs. But I think you've got to take something. You've got to take something good out of it. Otherwise, it's a long road ahead.
Definitely. I mean, I couldn't agree more. I mean, there's lots of research to show that gratitude is it's such a powerful thing in terms of its impact on physical health, our mental health, obviously. What I'd be interested in knowing is your perspective on whether it's a nature or nurture thing. Like, do you think some people are more predisposed towards being naturally grateful, or is it something that you can develop throughout your life?
I think some people are more predisposed to be naturally grateful. Yeah. I think so. You know, we have the glass half full and the glass half empty people.
Yeah.
You know, we all know them. I'm definitely a bit too overfull and kind of spilling out the side. And I kind of try and see the good in everything, which sometimes isn't really good for me.
Yeah.
But I think you can learn it. And I think if you're particularly with kids, I think just to teach them that actually, you know what, you're quite lucky. You're quite lucky you have this, or you are quite lucky you can do this, or you're quite lucky that as a family you can all sit down and have your dinner every night. It doesn't have to be something phenomenal. It just has to be something that you recognise that maybe other people don't have. And writing, I have a gratitude journal in the kitchen of my house, which, I mean, some of the things that are written in it are pretty terrible, you know, pathetic, my new shoes or whatever. But, you know, if you can kind of sit down and think about it, there's always something you could be grateful about. And I think we can teach ourselves to recognize that.
Definitely. I agree. I mean, it's about, you know, we have this natural tendency to notice the negative, the threats in our environment. You know, it's a natural evolutionary trait that we have. And so we can almost like just train our brain to, become better at noticing the positive, at being more appreciative, more grateful. And you mentioned gratitude journaling. I think that's a great way to do it.
And I say that not because I am, you know, Mother Earth or massively, you know, a meditator or anything like that. It's just that I worked with someone once and she was quite incredible and she used to go on these silent retreats and everything like that. And she used to write a gratitude journal. And I went, what? Really? What'd you do that for? She said, because it makes me feel better. And I said, wow, that's a great idea.
I mean, I don't know if you've come across the study by Martin Seligman where they got people to do a similar to a gratitude journal, but writing down things that you felt blessed about, you know, your three blessings each evening for a week. And up to 6 months later, there was still a positive impact on people's well-being just from that 1 week of effectively gratitude journaling. So, I mean, it's really, really powerful.
And it's free.
Exactly.
And also, I think it gives you a bit of time to step off the bus for 10 minutes every day, get away from your tech, and actually write something down. I think it really physically and mentally reinforces it. I'm going to get my dust it off now because it's somewhere in the kitchen. I'm going to bring it back out again in your honor.
Brilliant. What's also important to acknowledge, and you did do this to a degree, is that this isn't about Pollyanna optimism and just blind optimism and not noticing the challenges in our life. You know, that it's important to acknowledge those. And I came across an article of yours where you spoke about one of your personal challenges. I mean, also a personal blessing. But I'd just love to hear your a bit more about this. So you became a mother at the age of 40, and you wrote an article about the challenges therein of being a mother at that late. So tell us more about that.
Yes, I became a mum at 40, not by design, but by default, really. I'm not really a planner, and it was never, you know, I never had I don't even have an hourly plan on mind, a 10-year plan. So there I was, pregnant, had my baby, and I was always one of these people who said, oh, it's never, I won't be any different. It'll be fine. I'll be able to do everything, you know. And of course, it's not the same. It's never the same. And it's never the same in a phenomenally amazing way. But there are challenges. And, you know, even like the really simplest challenge for me was being tired. And trying to do a job. I was doing an awful lot of telly at the time. I was working clinically. I was doing 101 other things. I still wanted to have a social life. I still wanted to be able to do all the other things I did. And it was trying to find the balance. Yeah. And I suppose life is about that. You know, it's a great blessing, really, to be able to try and, if you're a person that can try and balance things, it's wonderful. But I think there's huge pressure on trying to be able to do everything. And as a doctor, an older mother, someone who's in the media, you really feel like all the eyes are on you. And I mean, I was useless at kind of things like, you know, taking my child from the car to put her into the buggy. I mean, I looked like I'd never been near a child in my entire life, you know, or you're on a plane and your child is crying or that type of thing. Or your child gets sick all over their top and you're out and you think, oh, everyone thinks I'm a terrible mum. And while I am a massively positive person, I think that pressure is palpable. And I probably was better at dealing with it at 40 than I would have been at 25 or 35. I mean, I don't know. But it was a challenge. It definitely was a challenge for me. But I'd like to think I got through it all right. Yeah. But there were so many things. And actually so many things with regards to, you know, your baby has a temperature or is crying in the night. And as a doctor who's done pediatrics, I should have been able to go, okay, well, this isn't, you know, the worry and the fact that, oh, maybe, what if I miss something? What if I actually miss something in my own child? My dad's a GP, and I very often would have, you know, phoned him up and said, look, Dad, what should I be doing here? Or my mum, if it was something more non-medical, but like, how'd you get this? How'd you get the baby to do this or not do this? And so, yeah, I really, really recognize that and continues to be a challenge.
Yeah.
Because now as my daughter keeps telling me, I'm the oldest mom in the class. No pressure.
I mean, to me, writing about your challenges, in other words, sharing them, to me, I see it as like, you know, courageous and also as a way to help normalize some of those kinds of difficulties that other people might be experiencing. Do you see it that way?
I do. And I have from a very young age always been I don't know whether it's the way I'm made or whether it's because I've had so many kind of failures and catastrophes, not massive ones in my life, but I'm a person who isn't afraid to fail. So I'm not, you know, I'm always there. I put my hand up and go, listen, I may be a doctor and I may be an older mum, but I don't know how to do this. So can someone give me a bit of a, throw me a bone? Yeah. I need some help. So I think that when you do that and when you are honest about how you feel about things or your struggles, I think that's really important. As a doctor, as a person who's been in the media, as a human being, as a friend, as a sister, as everything, really. Mm-hmm. As the person that sits next to someone on the train who maybe says, listen, I felt like that as well.
Yeah.
So sharing those experiences, I think, is really important.
Definitely. In a way, like us talking about some of our challenges gives people permission or the encouragement to do the same. And there's a lot of like catharsis in that.
Definitely. Mm. Definitely. Yeah.
There's a few things you've mentioned, which I want to pick up on, which I think are important. So you mentioned one of the realizations you had is that you can't do everything. You know, it's almost about embracing one's limits. And I know we had a little chat the other day and I mentioned this book. There's a book called 4,000 Weeks by Oliver Berkman. And it's about embracing your finitude, your limits, your boundaries as a human being. And that 4,000 weeks is on average the amount of weeks that we spend on this earth if you happen to live to 80 years old. And that seems like a really short amount of time, which really can hit home the fact that you cannot do everything. And in today's society, we seem to be, you know, I think it's got a lot to do with social media, and there's a lot of, it might be self-expectation, but I also think it's just what society is throwing at us. Like, we should do everything, like super achiever, this and that, but it's impossible. So I think it's about really recognizing what are the priorities in your life and then realizing that a lot of the rest you're going to have to just sort of let go of. Have you like made sort of a conscious decision to look at life in that way?
My philosophy in life has always been, if in your head and your heart you're content with being you,
And definitely.
You don't want to be anyone else. You don't want to be the person over the fence. You don't want to be that person on telly. You don't want to be your colleague or, you know, your best friend, or have aspirations to be as good as your sister, etc. If you're content with you and you are, you know, you're happy and you wouldn't want to be anyone else in your head or in yourself, I think you're probably all right. I think you're looking at things through. And that might be quite naive.
I mean,
I feel like I'm quite naive about life, but otherwise, I think if you think of every kind of thing that's going to go wrong, you wouldn't get out of bed in the morning.
Definitely. No, I don't see it as naivety. I see it as living authentically, and it's bringing a bit of that childlike spirit, but I think in a positive, mature way, if that makes any sense at all. You know, for what I'm taking from there is for you, it's about being authentic to who you are, which means you need to know who you are.
Yeah.
You need to know what your values are, what your intentions are in life. And I don't mean like goals necessarily, but intentions. How do I want to show up in the world? And then you just let life flow. Like, this is resonant for me. Like, I've never set these, I want to achieve this by then and this by then and this by then, because you're almost limiting life in a way by doing that. It's about being open to life as it unfolds and then just meeting it, like you say, with hope and optimism and as much grace as you can, I think.
My kind of bumps in the road in life in comparison to an awful lot of other people's aren't particularly major, but you know, things do knock you off your pedestal every so often, and that's quite leveling and makes you understand that you're human. And
of course.
But it's just dealing, and you know, also being able to get back up again when you're knocked down, and you know, say, right, okay, I've learned from that. Here we go again.
Yeah, definitely.
Where are we off to next?
Definitely. I think it speaks to, again, to hope, to resilience, optimism. So you seem like you are clearly a positive person. I'd love to hear your thoughts on this, and especially being a doctor. So like my take on mental health is that, I guess traditionally, or at least for the past 50 years, whatever it might be, that there's been quite a leaning towards pathology. So focus on the pathology side of things, on the problems, a very reactive approach. And I believe that there needs to be at least an equal focus on, you know, the positive, on the proactive, on the health affirming side of mental health. And I think there was a similar thing with physical health. You know, it was quite, you know, medicalized and problem focused, but that soon became more positive and proactive. You know, now people go for runs. Maybe 50 years ago, 60 years ago, they would have, if you see you running in the street, they would have wondered, what are you running away from? You know what I mean? Like, it's, but I think that shift needs to happen. It's starting to happen, but it needs to happen in mental health as well. You know, at Unmind, we talk about the analogy with dental health. You know, we brush our teeth every day, you know, in a proactive, preventative way. You know, can we not think about our mental health in the same way? So I would just love to hear your thoughts on that topic, the proactive versus reactive when it comes to mental health.
I couldn't agree with you more. I've been a doctor for, 25 plus years, a lot of years. And I've spent a lot of time in kind of screening. So I've done a lot of health screening, preventative health screening in corporate and individual clients and that. And it's always, I must go in and get my heart checked out, and I must get this checked out. And, you know, but we don't. We never, as doctors, we are really poor at, I mean, often you look at these health questionnaires and they don't even ask questions about sleep or, you know, energy, that type of thing, that are important factors to make us kind of click that there might be a problem with mental health. So, yeah, prioritizing those things that foster your mental health are really important, the same as we're saying, you know, lay off the butter, lay off the cream, lay off this, and then actually that's protective in terms of for your future health. So yeah, I think we should be much more focused on that message that, you know, you can do lots of things to safeguard your mental health before you run into problems. And one of those is definitely sleep. We're so blasé about sleep, and it's such a rite of passage. I only had 2 hours last night, and this, and, you know, I don't sleep very well, but it's just a thing, I don't sleep very well, when actually it's huge. You spend a third of your life asleep, so it's a huge thing. So I'm a big fan of sleep, but it's trying to get that messaging out there to patients that these are the things that are quite important in terms of the pillars of maintaining your mental health. So, you know, make sure that you're safeguarding them.
Yeah,
100%. Prioritizing them, really.
100%. I mean, not that you're preaching, but if you were preaching, you'd be preaching to the converted here. I had insomnia for just about 11 years.
Wow.
It's a really struggle. So I know what it's like to not get sleep and, you know, suffered and struggled. And then, I guess, overcame it. And I did it in my, you know, by following sleep hygiene, by all the things that we need to do, consistent bedtimes. But you're right, it is essential. It's like foundational almost for a life where you can show up, you know, with energy, with the capacity to deal with problems, with a sense of well-being, everything. It's almost like our life is the foundation for our life is getting a good night's sleep each night. I mean, that sounds a little bit potentially over the top, but I'm sure you can agree that not getting a good night's sleep, you show up more irritable the next day, less able to deal with problems. And if that is compounded over time, it's just really putting on the back foot.
It's huge. I mean, I would be a complete witch if I didn't sleep well. I mean, I'm one of those irritating people who I'm gone in 10 seconds. Gone. I could lie down there right now, Steve. I could be asleep. But yeah, it affects everything. I mean, it affects everything from your thinking to your bowels to, you know, even if you have a bad night's sleep, what you're going to eat the following day, it's going to be high calorie, high fat, etc. You know, we know all of this.
Yeah. But also it's I think it comes down to maybe the behaviors throughout the day taking us up towards bedtimes. Like, you know, we're arriving at bed feeling overly stressed, and then we actually end up associating the bed with like stress and not being able to sleep, and this creates this wrong conditioning, and I think it's a problem for a lot of people.
And where do we go before we go to bed? We go into the bathroom, which is the brightest room in the house.
Exactly.
And we brush our teeth, and we're all bright, and then we try and shut everything down again. I mean, there are a few design faults in the way we live, certainly. For sure.
I mean, I'm glad you mentioned that. My partner thought I was rather strange for quite some time, as I had red lights in the house at night. I mean, I'm probably taking it a bit too far, but anyway, it works.
Good.
So sleep, I mean, that is a foundation, but for physical and mental health. What other things would you see as foundations?
I think diet, you know, diet is really important, just because we know that our whole nutritional status is just generally our well-being hinges very much on it. Exercise also really important. I love that quote that says, you know, if you don't make room for exercise, you've got to make room for illness.
Yeah.
So it should be front and center again of our sort of daily maintenance to try and keep our mental health in check.
Definitely.
And I think surrounding yourself, you know, build your village, surround yourself with good people, and have those people, you know, we might as a society level have one good friend that we interact with and sort of offload on, or we might have certain friends for certain things or certain family members for certain things, but build your village, have those people there, those people that you can call on. Really, really phenomenally important. And I think even more important now because people aren't leaving home to go to work. So they don't have that sort of, if there's a problem at home, they don't have that person to talk to or interact with in the office. So, yeah, human interaction is important. And I think life is divided probably into drains and radiators in terms of the people we interact with. And, and some people are quite draining, whether that's, you know, they've got a lot going on and that helps you, or whether they're draining because they're negative. And then other people are radiators. And if I think if you're going through a pretty low phase of your life, or you're not feeling great, or you need to be a little bit upbeat, maybe steer clear of the drains and focus on the radiators. Or if you've got radiators in your life, really, you know, hang on to them.
Definitely. So you mentioned things like sleep and exercise and nutrition. You've mentioned social interaction, a good social group, relationships. We've spoken about, you know, mindset and thoughts and emotions, and that speaks to, I guess it's a biopsychosocial model, or we think about it as like the whole person approach to mental health, you know, like your psychological, physical and social, or like thoughts and emotions, brain and body and relationships and culture. What I find interesting here is, you know, there's this link between physical health and mental health, which I know that you're obviously an advocate for, you believe in that. And if you think about it at the level of like physiology and then thoughts and emotions and behaviors, it makes so much sense. Like if you're in a state of physiological stress, then the knock-on effects of that is going to be, you know, more negative thinking, less capacity to cope, which just speaks to the power of those kinds of relatively simple behaviors like getting enough sleep and eating healthy and moving your body, but just how like integral they are for mental and emotional well-being. But it's creating that healthy physiology, or at least that balanced physiology, from where the rest of the stuff can sort of flow from. Like, do you see it like that?
100% our general mental well-being very much impacts on our whole physical well-being. Yeah. You know, I mean, we know, well, the things I see all the time and things that I've seen, you know, more and more of because of COVID, either health anxiety, irritable bowel, you know, flare-ups of things like eczema, because people are stressed or anxious. And you know, it just goes to show that when the body is put under pressure or it's not looked after, it will say, hey, I'm not happy. I'm not happy here. Yeah. I'm going to give you a bit of irritable bowel. I'm going to give you a bit of a check and say, you know, I don't like how you're looking after me.
That's so important. You're learning to listen to the body. Your body's speaking to you all the time. What are your go-to strategies, proactive strategies that help you to look after your mind, your body?
I love to go out and exercise, whether that's run, walk, cycle. I love to empty my brain. I hate headphones. So I am not someone that sticks my headphones in and listens to music. In fact, I'm kind of the person that goes around and says, take that out. Listen to what I'm saying. And I love to just breathe the air, have a look, go for a walk, sit down, have a cup of tea on a bench, soak up what's going on around me. I love that. I just love it. I absolutely love it. I really, really enjoy the company of good friends and family. And one of the other things I do, which I love in terms of just switching off my brain, is I love shopping. And I know this sounds like a really vacuous thing, and I can't believe I'm saying it, but for me, on my own, shopping on my own, no phone, nobody wants me, and I can just go and have a little mooch around. I can try this on and I can do that. And I feel like I come back like some kind of, I don't know, on some kind of high, probably having spent too much money. But I just like to have my own kind of space and just go somewhere and be in my own head, or not even be in my own head, but be, you know, thinking, oh, so bizarre. But that is my kind of my go-to if I need to get out of the house for an hour and just, you know, change my brain into a different setting.
But it speaks to knowing what works for you. And I think it speaks to the power of solitude. You know, these days maybe it's been different during COVID, but I guess we're hyper-connected, like digitally, always doing something, always doing something. Just that time to be with yourself, almost distraction-free. It's like you say, not doing two things at once, not listening to music while doing this, but just being as you are, which can be uncomfortable for some people, but I think there's so much health in that solitude.
I very frequently say, can you imagine how wonderful it would be to be bored?
Yeah.
To sit there like teenagers and go, oh, I'm so bored. It's like, that must be like such a great feeling. But you're right. You're connected. Everyone's connected. And it's just trying to have that moment where actually, you know, we're not connected. And that thing of coming in and saying, right, phone's off, all tech off, put your phone in a box or put it somewhere and don't look at it. Because I think we're surrounded by, you know, I mean, even with watches now, and you can kind of this, well, someone wants me or I'm missing out on someone. It's hugely important to just get away from that. I also have my entirely great, wonderful, happy place in Ireland where I've been going to since I was really, really small, which is my like complete switch off. I'm like under anesthetic, so relaxed, so chilled, just a little place that we've always gone to, which I love. Which I always have in my mind, if I'm too busy or I've got too much going on, I know, in my head, I know, I'll always be able to get back to Baltimore.
Brilliant.
And unplug, which is a nice, safe, lovely, wonderful place for me.
Definitely. That sounds great. You mentioned, wouldn't it be nice to be bored? I almost feel like we need to learn to be bored. You know, we'd always, it's like mind candy all the time. There's always instant gratification, and I think social media plays into this. I mean, they're being designed by people who know how to keep you like addicted to the phone, but in so doing we are what we're doing is becoming more distractible, so we're not able to like focus on the things that we want to focus on, less capacity to be intentional. We are ruining our working memory, you know, like there's some real world effects here. And so I think you almost need to like self-impose some restrictions around this, just to practice being bored, practice doing one thing at a time, or maybe even doing nothing. I think the positive effects of that would be profound, because then you are, I guess, by doing that, become more present, first of all, more able to choose what you want to be paying attention to rather than being pulled in various directions. Because that capacity to choose what you want to pay attention to and then hold your attention, that defines your experience, your life. So I think we could all do with maybe self-imposed like digital detoxes, or just time, even a small amount of time in the day to disconnect. I think it's so important.
Digital detox, I think, is huge. And if it's a simple tip that someone wants to maybe unravel their mind for a little bit, just put yourself through a digital detox for a week and just say, I'm not going to look at my phone for an hour. You probably need it to get out of bed. See, this is the thing. We're trapped. It's my alarm clock. It's my this. It's my light when I get out to go to the toilet in the middle of the night. But it's really helpful. Because if people want you, they'll find you.
Yeah. There's another book called Digital Minimalism, which speaks to seeing... You know, we use our phone for so many things these days. But like you said, it's almost trapping us, keeping us hooked. But you can ask yourself the question, okay, so alarm clock, is there a better way than using my phone? Yes, there is. And then staying connected with friends, is there a better way? Perhaps there is, maybe I could call. Yes, you can start to think about it mindfully and then minimize the reasons to use your phone. Which I think is quite a good way of looking at it.
I always find it really, really tragic to be... Tragic is probably a bit over kill. But to be in a bank or in a supermarket and somebody is on their phone while they're being served by someone. I just think, is that really necessary? Are we that busy that we have to be so connected? And it's probably like organising your night out or whatever it is, and that we have to be so... kind of we are so fearful of that human interaction from a stranger or even when your phone rings. I mean, a lot of people, most of my office are like half my age, and you know, they're like, phone's ringing. I mean, someone's ringing me. This is like, nobody rings, everybody, you know, texts or whatever. And I think, I don't know, I think we've got it wrong. Maybe we'll all turn, maybe in 20 years' time, everyone will be chatting and writing letters and picking up the old telephone. Who knows?
I mean, it's so important. And I guess we shouldn't feel too, well, I think it's bad. We shouldn't feel too bad about it because they have been designed to become these like addictive machines. Yeah. You know, they give us dopamine hits. It's always like something novel. You're going to check, you know, like novelty. Your brain loves novelty. So it's, and it's been designed for that. So that's why I think you need to be quite rebellious and take like real definitive action. Otherwise it's going to be impossible to resist that temptation. Earlier, you were mentioning how sometimes we need to take responsibility for our decisions because it has an impact on more than just ourselves. I wonder what your thoughts are on the relationship between individual well-being and society. So I guess I'll elaborate a bit. So I see that there being a really important relationship between the two. The first part of it is that I think individual well-being is a crucial element in being able to co-create a good society, and a society that in turn helps to foster flourishing in the individuals within that society. Because, you know, we spoke earlier about how if you are not getting enough sleep and you're really, really stressed, you're feeling burnt out, your capacity to show up with compassion, your capacity to think well, your capacity to hold different perspectives, not just be happily focused on your own, like those are severely diminished. So in other words, your capacity to relate well to others and be like a good custodian of society and the earth is diminished. So like I really see it as super important that individuals are empowered to understand what is needed to create well-being in your life, and then like are empowered to be proactive around that and start moving towards flourishing. Like I see it as almost like an essential part of being able to address the big global problems that we have and just to create a better society. When I say better, like more compassionate, a society that is more supportive of well-being for more people, etc., etc. What are your thoughts on that relationship between the two?
I think it's hugely important as an individual. You are, you know, we're all part of a society, and what we certainly as a parent, as an employer, I have a duty to uphold certain standards or certainly be able to present myself in a way that is good and nurturing and healthy and embracing, so that the people who are alongside me or above me or below me, that might rub off on them.
Yeah.
You see it a lot in corporate life, obviously, and I mean less so, I suppose, at the moment because people are working from home, but that notion of, you know, people going into a huge corporate office and actually it's almost like that environment is you know, that is the environment that you're going to spend most of your time in. You're going to talk to your colleagues, certainly in the week, far more than you're going to talk to your family. You're going to eat with them. You're going to argue with them. You might form relationships with them. And there's a huge role there, I think, for organizations to be able to play a fundamental role in how actually we can change health behaviors.
Yeah.
School, I think, is really important. And across things like sport. So I think there are great opportunities there. But ultimately, as I suppose, as parents and as adults, what we really should be doing is showing, you know, we're all ultimately responsible for ourselves, aren't we?
Yeah.
So we should be showing those good behavior traits and hoping that people would go, oh, actually, that's probably a better path to take on than the smoking, alcohol, you know, eating badly. Sometimes you see, and you certainly see it in general practice, that you may have patients who actually have changed behaviours because of their children, or certainly their young adult children, who said, you know, Mum, why are you smoking? Or, you know, why don't you exercise? I go to the gym all the time. But I think at a society level, I think the opportunities in bigger organisations are huge.
Yeah, definitely.
To try and get people to just open their eyes and see, really.
Yeah, I couldn't agree more. Like the analogy that we sometimes use is the culture. So let's use an organization. The organizational culture is the soil the conditions within that culture, you know, the sun, the rain, etc. And the employees are, you know, the acorn. They'll only grow and flourish into a beautiful acorn tree if the conditions are right, if the soil is healthy, if there's sun, if there's rain. But I guess what's interesting here, so, you know, so an acorn doesn't create the soil and it doesn't create the sun and the rain, but in our situation here, we as human beings are co-creating that society, which is why I think it comes back down to the health of individuals as well and the values of individuals as being like supremely important. So it's a bit of a chicken egg thing, and it's like a hopefully a virtuous cycle rather than a toxic cycle. And so I just feel like our awareness needs to raise, and we need to realize that it's not just like a nice to have, but our individual and then, you know, societal well-being is literally fundamental to being able to navigate the challenges we face and like create a better world. Like it sounds quite like grandiose, but if you think about it logically, it seems like that is what we're facing.
My daughter comes home from school, she's 9, she's like, I'm gonna write to Toto and I'm gonna do this. Wouldn't it be amazing if we had that much energy and that much enthusiasm behind, I mean, we're getting it with mental health, which is good, but with just health as a whole,
sure,
and trying to, you know, let's get society, let's get everyone helping each other out,
definitely,
to make them as healthy as they possibly can, because it's a win-win.
Definitely,
it's a win if you're an employer, it's a win if you're a teacher, it's a win if you're a parent, you know, I think that would be phenomenal.
Exactly.
But we don't seem to have that momentum behind, because I suppose health is still, although people are proactive about their health, health is still seen as not being well, isn't it, really? We still have that not being well tag, and mental health still, that
exactly.
I haven't got it, so now I'm going to try and foster it. And we have to get over that.
I mean, I really agree with that. I almost think that's one of the roots of the problem is the hyper focus on what's wrong. You know, it's the pathogenic approach, the reactive approach. We need to like totally shift to rather focusing on how can we create a flourishing society.
Mm-hmm.
The first, well, not the first step, but an essential step is flourishing individuals. So it literally requires a paradigm shift. And I think that's in, you know, physical health, mental health, and just society at large. And the way I see it is, you know, you can imagine three concentric circles. You've got I, and then the we, and then the all. If the I is not healthy, then the we is not going to be healthy. In other words, relationships are not going to be healthy, and then the all is not going to be healthy. Like, it requires the healthy I, which is why that personal responsibility. And I use that with caution. There are vulnerable people out there. The people have more capacity to take a proactive approach to their mental health. So whatever agency you have in your life, you should use that to create well-being for yourself and then co-create cultures and societies that support others as well. Like it's just changing how we think about health, really.
Yeah, I think I'm going back to what I said about having your kind of team of people around you, your go-tos, you know, we've got to start that at a young age. We've got to start that as you know, recognizing and being champions for health and mental well-being from a really young age.
Exactly. So it's like health and mental health promotion. Like that's what we try to promote, raise awareness around education, promotion. Imagine that you're able to project into the future and meet your older, wiser self. So the older, wiser self that has learned life lessons, and you're able to spend a few minutes with your wiser self having a conversation. What do you think that older, wiser self would tell you now to help guide the rest of your life?
I think my older, wiser self would probably tell me to look around and take a bit of a pause, because I do sometimes run around like a headless chicken, and I could probably give more time to lots of things that I don't give time to. I think there are more important things in life than some of the things that I do, that I put time into. So yeah, you know, I could probably be a better friend, I could be a better sister, you can always be a better mother. And I think that that's probably, you know, take a take a little step back and because time, people, all people ever want from you is your time. And I think sometimes maybe I don't have enough time. I often say I wish there were 7 or 8 days in the week.
Yeah.
Because I'd have more time, but actually there aren't. So I should, you know, be a bit more conscious of, as you've said, and that really stuck with me, that 4,000, you know, how many of those we waste away. So yeah, be focused on. We're not here for a very long time, so we've got to make the most of it.
That sounds like wise advice. Brilliant. Well, thank you so much. I've really enjoyed speaking with you today.
Thank you for having me.
Thanks for listening. We'll be back next week with another episode and another brilliant guest. Flourish is a podcast from Unmind, the mental health platform transforming the world of workplace well-being. To find out more, visit unmind.com or follow us on socials at UnmindHQ. You can also find me, your host, on Instagram at Steve@Unmind. See you next time.